All right, so before discussing anything of substance today, I'd like to just explain how grades were determined in the first exam. The first midterm has been graded, and I think your grade should be posted on your Learn at UW site. So what we did was this. We took what the best grade in the class was, which was 44 points out of the 46 possible on the midterm, and we called that 100. And then I mechanically went down by 10%. So anything above 90 or above was an A. 80 to 90 was a B or an AB. 70 to 79 was a C or a BC, and so on. So I'm not grading on what's called a curve. When a professor grades on a curve, what they decide in advance is what percentage of the class is going to get an A, what percentage is going to get a B, and what percentage is going to get a C. And then they decide where the cut points are based on what you have to do to produce that distribution. That's what's called grading on a curve. What grading on a curve means is that it's impossible for everybody to do well, because it's by design you're going to have a particular distribution of grades in a class. I don't think that's a reasonable way to grade students. It means that if you happen to have a year where everybody are eager beavers and working really hard and they all do very well on the exam, they still will have that same distribution. So what I do is simply take what is still, of course, ultimately a kind of arbitrary cut points, but just go down by 10 percentiles in this way. I create a bigger band for A's at the top. That is, there's a range from 90 to 100 for A's. And then go down by 5%, 5 points. This isn't percent of students; it's points on the test. And this is then the distribution for the class. One other just note: so some of you, I'm sure, will be disappointed. Some of you who got grades below what you feel you could do, and particularly there are students who failed the test or got D's. My general policy about grades in a class like this is to not be rigidly mechanical in how I add up the three tests. So a student who blows the first test and does really well, makes substantial improvement on the second and third test. So it's clear that they saw that there was something wrong, they figured out what to do about it, and then did much better. Then I tell the TAs to give less weight to the first test. It's not that I have a formula for this. You know, sometimes I'm criticized for not having absolutely unambiguous rules for how I weight the first exam if the second exam is a lot better. I think it's better to have a little bit of flexibility in this way, to respond to the specific circumstances of students rather than to try to concoct some completely rigid but effective rule. But you should know, if you didn't do well on the first test, that you can redeem yourself. You can, in fact, end up with a good grade in the class. Whereas if you failed the first test and you just mechanically added the three tests together, it would be impossible to get a really good grade. You might be able to raise it to a C, maybe a BC, but you couldn't do better than that. Well, working with the TAs, showing that you're trying to figure out what went wrong, working on study skills with the TAs, you know, collaboratively to improve the way things turn out on the next exams, all of that will make a difference in how this plays out. So again, if you have questions, your TAs in their office hours will go over your individual tests with you to show where the problems occurred. We don't give your tests back to you. I mean, you can see them in their office. We don't give them back to students because the experience is, if we do, they end up on file in various fraternity and sorority houses, so that, and since the imagination of professors is fairly limited to create new exams every year, as you can see, it creates problems of fairness in the way we've been talking about fairness. Okay, enough of that. I want to just briefly talk about two of the graphs that we went through it pretty hurriedly at the end of the last lecture, just because I think they have lessons that are going to be important to keep in mind throughout this discussion of inequality over the next 4 weeks. These were the graphs that showed the relationship between the degree of income inequality in a country and various indicators of well-being. I want to be sure that everybody understands how to read this kind of graph. I assume that most of you have had courses where you've been shown how to read graphs, but still it's worth just bringing this back into mind. So this is what's called a linear relationship. That's when you draw a straight line. Often when you have data like this, a straight line isn't such a good approximation. You know, sometimes things look like that. This is actually pretty remarkable. If that straight line that's drawn through all those points seems to track the data pretty well. The only country that seems really out of whack with this pretty much straight line is the U.S., which is above the line quite a bit. Let's see where Denmark... Yeah, here's our Danish friends live here. We live way up there. You know, as in the current political season, the comment is made in some of the political debates that the Democrats want the United States to be more European, and that's supposed to be a bad thing. If you look at this relationship between this broad index of health and social problems and how income inequality links to that, it doesn't look to me like it would be such a bad thing to be down at this part of the graph rather than way up there in the stratosphere. So remember, what we're showing here is not a connection between poverty and well-being. This is a connection between inequality and well-being. It shows that countries that have overall high levels of inequality, overall levels of well-being are lower. This isn't well-being of the poor in countries with high inequality. It's the average well-being of people in the country, in a country with high versus low inequality. That's the thing to remember. And the central message there, remember, this was part of the discussion about why on pragmatic grounds we might have an objection to high levels of inequality. Just for practical reasons, what are its consequences in the world? The claim here is that one of the consequences in the world of high levels of inequality is higher levels of human suffering than would occur if we had lower levels of inequality. And that's not something that just affects the people at the bottom. It affects the average person in the society. So that was this graph. The other one that I wanted to just revisit is this graph that shows the relationship between high inequality and social mobility. It's often claimed that the United States is the land of opportunity, that here is the place where social mobility is possible. And the kind of idea there is that, yes, we have a lot of inequality, but at least it's an open society where people can move from bottom to top, or from bottom to middle, or from middle to top. Social mobility refers to the probability that someone moves up or down, that's called downward mobility, moves up or down in the overall structure of the society relative to their parents. So it might be a reasonable argument in favor of higher levels of inequality if it promoted social mobility, if it actually expanded opportunities for people. Right? So that would be one of the justifications. What's good and what's bad? You have your list of pros and cons. If it were the case that high inequality was associated with high social mobility, that would be one of the reasons why we might say, yes, we should. It's okay to have high inequality, even if there were other objections to it. So even if on the on the grounds of fairness that we discussed last time, you might say, well, that level of inequality isn't fair, but it has this practical advantage. What this graph shows is that it simply doesn't have that practical advantage. The more inequality you have in a society, the less social mobility. Now, a lot, of course, depends on exactly what we mean. How do we measure social mobility? And, you know, those of you who may become sociologists and study sociology, you'll see that there are huge debates about the best way to do this. There's all sorts of alternative measures. This particular graph is based on a pretty simple measure, although not such a bad one. It has to do with how tight is the association between parents' income and children's income when the children become adults. I don't remember exactly the study. I believe this is at age 30. So it's the income of people at age 30 compared to their parents' income. How strong is that correlation? Their parents' income when they were growing up. So it's looking at their social origins and their destination and how tightly correlated are those, the incomes of parents and adult children. And as you see again, look at our friends from Denmark. Denmark has the highest social mobility of the countries for which there is data on this. So they rank way up at the top. The Nordic countries generally are good. But look, I mean, Canada doesn't do so badly either. It's a near neighbor. Canada's rather like the United States in many ways, but it has much less inequality. All right, that's the wrap-up from last time. Now we're going to discuss class. So, first a comment about the word class. Lauren, did you have your hand up for something? Yeah, I think I'm recording. Let's see. I thought I turned it on. Yes, 12 minutes and 19 seconds worth. But thanks. First, a comment about the word class. You've noticed if you've been watching the political debates and other matters that the word class gets thrown around a lot in the current political season, but always with an adjective. What's the adjective that's always put before it? Middle. We're talking about what's good for the middle class. Middle class tax cuts. What's good for the middle class? The middle class is having a hard time. That's one way of using the term class, where the distinctions that are being made are between something that's broadly in the middle and something that's at the top and something that's at the bottom. When you invoke the middle class, the word middle suggests that you're using the term class to distinguish a broad group from two exceptional groups. The middle class is contrasted to the poor, and the middle class is contrasted to the rich. That's what's called a gradational concept of class. Class is just a ladder. And the middle is some broad chunk in the middle. That's one legitimate way of using the term class. And many sociologists, as well as politicians, use the word class in just that way, as a very broad and loose term to describe how a person is located on the basis of their individual attributes and material conditions of life. How are you located within a scale that goes from bottom to top? The middle class then being the middle of a scale. There are, however, other ways of thinking about class. So this is the first, individual attributes. Classes are clusters of individual attributes connected to unequal material conditions. That's probably the most common way that the word is used in the United States today. But that's only one of the ways of thinking about the idea of class. And there are two other ways I want to talk about, not because I want to argue that you shouldn't use class in this very broad gradational way, graded ladders, upper, middle, lower, in this gradational way. It's not that I don't think that there's anything wrong with using the word class that way, but it's a pretty impoverished concept. It doesn't tell you a lot about how the society is organized. And there are other ways that sociologists have proposed that we think about class that I think offer a much deeper understanding of how the society works. So remember, the title of this course is American Society, How It Really Works. And I think the concept of class that we need to understand how it really works needs to be a richer concept, a more complicated concept than just the scalar notion of class. So I want to introduce two other concepts of class. One that's called the opportunity hoarding concept of class. That phrase, opportunity hoarding, is just a way to anchor the second concept. And a third concept, which is the most difficult and controversial, it's a concept of class that's linked to the ideas of exploitation and domination. Because that's both the most controversial and the least familiar, I'll spend more time on this third concept of class, at least so you'll understand what it means, not so that you necessarily feel it's the concept of class that you feel most comfortable with. Okay, so first, opportunity hoarding. What is meant by this idea? The key idea in the notion of opportunity hoarding is that there are a variety of social processes that exist in the world which exclude people from access to economically valuable resources. People monopolize those positions in ways that exclude others. And that process of exclusion always involves some form of power. So opportunity hoarding means one group of people is able to capture a certain set of positions in society and create barriers that exclude other people from getting access. The simplest form of exclusion, the form of exclusion that people just take for granted, they don't even think of it as a form of exclusion, are property rights. Property rights are a way of excluding people from access to certain kinds of economic resources. That's what a property right means. So if you own a factory, if you own the means of production, what the word own means is you have the power to exclude other people from getting access. They have access to those means of production only on your permission. And you back that exclusion with the power of the state. The state protects your property. That's one of the main things that states do, is they protect property rights. But protecting property rights means that people are being excluded from using those means of production unless you give them permission. That's exclusion. And certain consequences flow from it. If you think about an ordinary factory, which is thinking about whether it should move its business to another country because labor is cheaper. Well, just think about the differences in the way that decision would be made if the workers in the factory were also the owners, as opposed to the owners being monopolizing the property rights in the factory. The decision would be an entirely different kind of decision. It's a totally different sort of world in which the owners of the factory are different from the people who actually use the means of production. Now, when the owners are different from the people who actually use the means of production, that's a particular kind of social system under which economic activity is organized. What do we call that kind of social system? Just been examined about it. You should know the answer to that. What's the name for a social system in which the owners of the means of production are different from the workers who are employed to use it? Capitalism, right. That's a capitalist system. That's the basic structure of this kind of economic organization. What I'm just arguing here then is that capitalism should be thought of as a particular kind of class system, because there's a particular mechanism, a particular process of exclusion, of opportunity hoarding, of monopoly over particular kinds of positions, that is absolutely at the core of defining that as an economic system. It's a particular way of organizing these relations, where the owners of the means of production have the power to exclude other people from access to their means of production. There's other forms, other mechanisms of exclusion, however, as well in contemporary American society. The most important centers around education. Education is not simply a way of getting skills and knowledge. It's also a way of getting a credential. There's a distinction between what you learn when you go to law school or medical school or as undergraduates, what you learn in the sense of the actual knowledge that you that becomes part of your subjective state, part of your consciousness, part of your understanding of the world, your skills. There's a distinction between that and the credential you get, which certifies you as having gone through a particular educational process. You cannot be a lawyer in the United States, no matter how much law you know, unless you have a law degree. You cannot be a doctor, no matter how skillful, whether you've memorized the entire, you know, Gray's Anatomy and all the other textbooks of medical school. Even if you could pass all the exams, even if you could pass the board certified exams, you cannot be a doctor unless you have a medical degree. Credentials are a way of restricting who can practice particular kinds of occupations. Now, there may be good reason for this. This is, you know, the point here is separate from whether it's justified. It may be that on balance, it's much better to exclude people who don't have degrees, even though you will occasionally exclude somebody who would be much better at it than the average person with a degree. You know, it still might be good social policy because you're much more worried about the other mistake, letting quacks practice medicine, than you are excluding some brilliant physician who just doesn't happen to have a medical degree. So this could be justified, but it has the effect of creating a monopoly, creating exclusionary mechanisms, hoarding those positions. This wouldn't be such a problem if there was equal access to the education process. So you see how this feeds into a series of complicated social issues. The opportunity hoarding that comes from the fact of a credential would not be so exclusionary if all children had equal access to the necessary education in order to gain admission to the process by which you got a credential. But because of the way education is funded, because of the very high costs to get especially advanced degrees, because of the problem of debt that people incur when they go for higher credentials, because of all these things, not to mention the problem of the inadequacy of the initial educational resources and how they're allocated to children, because of all this, the credentialing system becomes a way of enforcing privilege, not just certifying skill. And that's what renders it part of the class system. It's a way of enforcing privilege. That is, the exclusion divides the world into those who have access to these good jobs and those who don't. It's a way of enforcing privilege, not just certifying competence. This kind of inequality, inequality that's bound up with opportunity hoarding, is different from the gradational inequality that I described in the first use of the word class, you know, just with higher, middle, and lower. Because in this kind of inequality, you can't even talk about it unless you're talking about a social relationship between people. This is what is called relational inequality. So this is something you might put a little asterisk by in your notes. It's one of these ideas that, who knows, could appear on an exam in some not too distant future. The distinction between gradational inequality and relational inequality. In gradational inequality, all that you know is that somebody has more or less of something. But the people with more and the people with less don't necessarily have any kind of interaction. in relational inequality, the inequality is grounded in a social relationship. A property right is a social relationship because it implies the power to exclude people, not simply a difference in their attributes. This will become even clearer when we talk about the third concept of class in a moment. And this is an idea that I'll be referring to many times, so it'll gradually get clearer. As in many theoretical discussions, the first time you hear a contrast, it's not quite nailed down, it's a bit elusive. As you see the distinction between relational and gradational inequality in more contexts, I think gradually this will become a potent and understandable distinction. All right, that's our second concept of class, opportunity hoarding. The third concept of class is based on this, this is just repeating what I just said, the gradational versus relational. The third concept of class is by far the most controversial, and it's grounded in these two terms, exploitation and domination. For those of you who are sociologists, by the way, and want some references of sort of famous figures in the history of sociology, the opportunity hoarding concept of class is associated with the sociologist Max Weber, W-E-B-E-R, Weber, but pronounced Weber, a German sociologist at the beginning of the 20th century. He is probably the most influential early 20th century social thinker, sociologist, in the development of modern sociology. I think most people would say that. And his concept of class was grounded in this notion of opportunity hoarding. The concept of class that's connected to the idea of exploitation and domination is associated with a much more notorious figure in the history of social thought. This is the concept of class associated with the work of Karl Marx. And it's certainly the most contentious. The terms exploitation and domination themselves are morally charged. It's pretty hard to, with a straight face, to say exploitation is a really good thing. Exploitation is nice. You know, the term exploitation is laden with moral judgment. The term domination is not quite as harsh as exploitation. There are times when people say, yes, it's appropriate for one group to dominate another. But still, you know, really, nobody says domination is, a world filled with domination is a better world than a world without domination. So both exploitation and domination are critical concepts, not merely descriptive. They do bring with them a moral judgment. And many people object to this way of thinking about class and inequality precisely because of the way it infuses this discussion with this morally charged language. And, you know, I think there's arguments on both sides of that issue. That is it a good or bad thing to infuse our theoretical discussions with morally charged language? I think it's a good thing to do so if it's done carefully and clearly, not if it's done sneakily through the back door, if it's done forthrightly, and if the reasons for the moral inflection within these terms is made clear. In any case, let's look at what this is all about. In opportunity hoarding, in the previous concept of class, there is benefit to the advantaged from the exclusion of the disadvantaged, right? So there's benefit to the people who are able to hoard an opportunity. They gain a benefit by virtue of excluding others. In exploitation and domination, the social relationships that we're talking about extend to the very activities of people, not just to their exclusion, but to their very activities. Let me just give you a really simple example, which I think is just transparent. An example where everyone would agree, yes, this is an instance of exploitation and domination. You don't need to have some fancy sociological theory. Let's look at slavery in the United States before the Civil War. So on a slave plantation, there were basically two classes of people. There were slave owners and there were slaves. No, there are a few other types of people that were neither slave owners nor slaves, but it's not really much of a simplification to say that on the slave plantation, there were slave owners and slaves. It would be a gross misrepresentation of inequality to say simply, slave owners are the rich class and slaves are the poor class. That these two groups differ by how much income they have. If somebody said that's the description of a slave plantation, you'd say, what? You know, you missed the whole character of structure of that inequality. It's simply not captured by the gradational aspects of the inequality. Even though it's true that the slave owners were rich and the slaves were poor, that's not the core character of that environment. But it's also not quite enough to simply talk about opportunity hoarding. Not quite sufficient to say, yes, on a slave plantation, the slave owners monopolize the means of production and the slaves are excluded. That doesn't quite capture it yet. What really captures it is that the slave owners dominate the slaves. They control their lives and activities, and by virtue of that, exploit them. That is, the wealth and well-being of the slave owners depends upon the laboring activity of the slaves. There's an interdependency. The slave owners depend upon the lives and activities of the slaves. Now, that's a very strong relationship. If I say, I depend upon your activity for my well-being, we've had a lot of me and you back and forth in that sentence. That's a description of a social relationship, not just a difference, and not just privilege relative to disadvantage. It's a statement about our interconnection. And that, of course, is the guts of what slavery was all about. It was about an interconnection between slaves and slave owners, and how fraught with tension and conflict and human abuse that social relationship was. And the terms domination and exploitation seem to fit quite naturally with the character of the relationship between slave owner and slave. I think one simple way to think about this interdependency is to say, with respect to the initial gradational description, rich and poor, what we get when we add these relational descriptions is the rich are rich because the poor are poor. And the poor are poor because the rich have taken away from them the fruits of their labor on the slave plantation. And almost nobody would disagree with that as a description of how slavery worked. And therefore, slavery is not indicted simply because of the inequality of rich and poor. It's indicted because of the way in which the rich are rich and the poor are kept poor. That is, by the social relations of domination and exploitation that define that class relation. That's clear for slavery. The question is there anything about that kind of description which also applies to capitalism? So one view is, yes, that's true for slavery, but once slavery was abolished, we now are in a world of freedom where domination is gone and exploitation has disappeared, except in very fringy ways. That exploitation and domination are no longer at the center of the way we organize our economic life. So the class relations in capitalism, some people would argue, are characterized by gradational inequality. There are rich and poor, that's obvious, and a middle. And it's characterized by opportunity hoarding. We do have property rights and we do have credentials. That's also obvious. But some people say it's no longer characterized by domination and exploitation. And that's why, as I said, it's very controversial to introduce these ideas for an analysis of contemporary American society. What I'd like to do as a way of explaining why I think this is relevant is to have a little entertainment. I'm going to introduce you to the saga of Little Abner and the Shmoo as a way of showing why the concept of exploitation actually is relevant for capitalism as well, and to give more clarity as to exactly what I'm talking about when I refer to the concept of exploitation. So you can relax a little bit. This is both going to be, I think, amusing, but it's also dead serious. Let me tell you the story. How many of you have heard of Little Abner? Is this a familiar? Has this been lost to the American imagination? Little Abner, Daisy May, Fearless Fosdick. Ah, dear. From the late 1930s into the 60s, a cartoonist named Al Capp wrote a comic strip called Little Abner that appeared in Sunday newspapers in an era where everybody got Sunday newspapers. And the comic strip was called Little Abner. Some of the famous characters, his girlfriend was Daisy May, and Fearless Fosdick was an FBI agent who was always after Little Abner for various nefarious things. Little Abner and his fellow characters in the comic strip lived in the Ozark Mountains of Arkansas. I like to think of him as living in the hills near where Bill Clinton was born. He was born in Hope, Arkansas. Little Abner lived in a little town called Dog Patch. Dog Patch was allegedly the poorest community in the United States. Well, the episode I want to tell you about appeared in the comic strip in the late 1940s. The background story of the Shmoo, Little Abner and the Shmoo, is this. Supposedly, the U.S. Army after World War II dumped radioactive waste in the Ozark Mountains, and this caused the mutation of some critter in the forests of the Ozark Mountains, caused the mutation into what became known as the Shmoo. I think, as you will, and you'll see the reason for this shortly, I think the Shmoo is probably a mutation of a wild turkey. They kind of look like a turkey. The Shmoo turns out to have some remarkable powers. So here's why everybody would like a Shmoo. The Shmoo has one purpose in life, which is to serve the needs of humanity. They do this by turning themselves into the things you need, but not into luxuries. So if you wake up in the morning and you're hungry and you want a bowl of oatmeal, and you have a Shmoo, it'll turn itself into a bowl of oatmeal. If you wake up and you want a plate of caviar, it won't do it. It'll only turn itself into basic necessities. It's telepathic. You don't even have to tell it to turn itself. It knows what you want. It reads your mind. It turns yourself into your bowl of oatmeal. And because they're so concerned about your well-being, they replicate themselves before transforming, so you have an endless supply. The Shmoo, in other words, I think, taps into some great symbolic resonances in Western civilization. The origins myth of Western civilization is Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden, right? Every culture has its origin story. Our origin story is the Garden of Eden, Adam and Eve. When they sin against the command of God by eating of the tree of knowledge and are kicked out of the Garden of Eden. Many bad things happen to them as punishments. You know, things like death and childbirth. I mean, all these punishments that are wrought by God on Adam and Eve. But one of the punishments is, from now on, you have to earn your bread by the sweat of your brow. That's one of the consequences of expulsion from the Garden of Eden, is earning your bread by the sweat of your brow. Well, what does the Shmoo do? The shmu precisely gives you bread without the sweat of your brow. The shmu, in other words, restores humanity to the Garden of Eden with respect to basic necessities. So that's a pretty potent idea. It's a pretty potent myth. The shmu is sort of manna from heaven. You know, it comes from outside of human effort, and it provides for all of our basic needs. Well, it turns out that little Abner found a shmu outside of Dogpatch and brought it back. So all the residents of Dogpatch now have a shmu. And let us begin the story. What's happening in the story is that two industrialists, an industrialist and his chief manager, are on a tour to try to find the best place to build a new factory. And now, PU, we're coming to a spot where folks are so ignorant, they'd never dream of asking more than we're willing to pay. And they'll never get rich on that. Here, they haven't been spoiled by that silly fad of a mere 8-hour day. These miserable rats are in such desperate need, they'll work for a good old-fashioned 16-hour day. You're a bright boy. How did you find such a splendid spot to move our factory? Statistics show that there are more undernourished people in Dogpatch than any place. Those are the kind I like to deal with. They're so grateful, bless them. These poor, ignorant wretches will be grateful for the chance to work 16 hours a day, 7 days a week. For $7 a week, they've never heard of anything better, and we'll never tell them. Oh, you're a bright lad. The board may well give you a $500,000 bonus again this year. Remember, this is 1947 dollars. If you inflate this to current dollars, that's probably something like a $7 or $8 million bonus. But maybe we can pay him even less. Question one of them. How would you like to earn $7 a week? Did you say $7 for just 1 week? Oh, no, I said six. That would have been a mighty tremendous fortune, B.S. What do you mean, B.S.? Before schmooze. Only 18 hours of hard labor a day? Only 7 days a week? And you'd pay us $6 for just that? That would have been a mighty juicy proposition, B.S. Meaning before schmooze, and now you can see why my hypothesis that the shmu is a former turkey that's been transformed, why at least it has, it's a plausible hypothesis. But nobody what's got shmooze has to work anymore, and anybody can have for free. Shmooze does everything. Everything? Oh, I suppose they provide you with the necessities of life. Milk, butter, eggs, meat. Stop laughing, you fool. Look. Great Scott, P.U., do you realize what the shmoo means? Nobody will have to work hard anymore. But who will do the long, dreary, backbreaking labor in our canning factories? Now, I'd like to make an editorial comment here. This is a subtle theoretical point. And the point is, sociologically speaking, the resident of Dogpatch, and I quote him directly, we have the record, he says, nobody what's got schmooze has to work anymore. The resident of Dogpatch is a Weberian. He's read Max Weber. He thinks that all the schmoo does is breaks down the opportunity hoarding. Nobody has to work anymore. You don't have to sell your labor to an employer. The capitalist is a Marxist. Capitalist realizes that the real problem here is that nobody will work hard anymore. That you won't be able to extract effort from people because the shmoo gives people power. They can refuse to work hard, not just simply refuse to work. Back to the story. Nobody, and what's worse, nobody will need our canned stuff anymore. The shmoo provides all types of food, fresh and free. Free food for everybody. That's horrible. The shmoo must go. It's either it or us. Thank heavens its sinister influence hasn't spread yet. Blast you, Wormley. Why are you stopping? Because I've quit. I snuck a brace of shmoos under my coat in Dogpatch. Now I've got a whole herd of them. I'll never have to take your guff anymore, P.U. Ah, shmoos stop a certain kind of abuse of subordinates as well. I'll forget the shmoo menace by taking Choo-Choo to dinner. That poor showgirl has been unemployed so long, she'll even go out with me for a square meal. Oh, I'd love to go to dinner with you, honey pot. I'll get you a big steak and you can take that steak and slap your own fat face with it. There's good schmooze tonight. As an historical anecdote here, or comment, in 1947, this is after the New Deal period, after the 30s, the first part of the story about how the schmoo disrupts the relationship between employers and employees, that's kind of in the air, that sort of idea. The notion of class, exploitation, workers, capitalists, this was part of the common culture of intellectuals, whether you were on the left or the right, it didn't matter. Everybody would have understood that. The idea that the schmoo would disrupt gender domination, male domination, that's actually a way more insightful point that Al Capp is making. Now, here's the kind of interesting irony here. Al Capp was no proto-feminist. I mean, his comic strips are just rampant sexism from start to finish. It's not that he was expressing any values that would become later feminist values, that is, values that women shouldn't be treated that way. Rather, he was simply playing out a kind of thought experiment. He was just intrigued with this interesting idea. Hey, what would happen if we brought schmooze into the world? And he made what I think is basically a kind of intellectual discovery. It's as if he was making a formal theoretical argument in sociology or in economics. This was a deductive conclusion from the premise, what would happen if schmooze entered into gender relations? Ah, women would have exit options. They would not have to agree to things they didn't want simply because men controlled resources. The schmoo disrupts gender domination, not just class exploitation. Well, so you know what happens in the story. You know, the stock market is crashing, the food industry is collapsing because schmooze are spreading. There's a council of industrialists that meet in New York. What you see just before that is that a lot of them are jumping out of windows, but then they meet in a council. They hire the mafia to go to Dogpatch to exterminate the schmooze. And the schmooze, because they're so obliging, they just all line up and the mafia shoots them all down. Little Abner sneaks away with a couple of them and takes them off into the woods. So there's a couple of surviving schmooze, and so the story of the schmoo can continue. All right, well, what are we to make of this story of the schmoo? Why do I think this is a relevant story for our theoretical discussions? Let's think of it abstractly. Here, actually, I'll put that back in a moment. Let's think of it abstractly. We have two classes of people in Dogpatch, right? In the story. There's the industrialists, the rich capitalists who want to start a factory, and there's the poor, benighted denizens of Dogpatch who have nothing except the schmoo. So we have these two classes. And let's ask the following question. If there are four possible fates for the schmoo, four things could happen. Here are the four things that could happen to the schmoo. Everybody could get a schmoo. That's one possibility. Only the poor could get the schmoo. That's the second possibility. Only the rich get the schmoo. That's the third possibility. Nobody gets a schmoo. That's the fourth possibility. Right? These are four possibilities. Everybody gets it. Only the poor, only the rich. Destroy them. And let's ask the question, what is the rank ordering of these preferences for the rich capitalist and the poor Dogpatch residents? The rich and the poor, capitalist workers, whichever language you prefer, what are their preferences for what should happen to the schmoo? What's the thing they would like most? If they can't get that, what's their second choice? What's their third choice? And what's their fourth choice? Now that's called a preference ordering. Preference ordering. It's a bit like, remember when we did the free rider problem and the kind of game theory, we said, here are these four possibilities. A, B, C, and D. What's their preference ordering? What would they like best? What's their second choice, third choice, and fourth choice? Well, this is a similar kind of thing. What's their rank ordering of preferences? If you could have a shmoo. I mean, if I asked all of you, what do you think, what would you like? Forget about the story. What would be your first choice if you could snap your fingers and either have nobody have shmooze, everybody have shmooze, only the rich have shmooze, or only the poor? What would be your first choice? How many people would say everyone? Okay, how many people think that their first choice would be only the rich get the shmoo? Ah, well, that's nice. I'm glad. I mean, of course, it might be a little awkward given the first vote for anybody who in their heart of hearts thinks that only the rich should get shmooze. I can understand why you are hesitant to raise your hand. But I will prefer to the interpretation that actually nobody holds such preferences. Well, let's ask the question, what if we had in this very simplified world of capitalists and of rich and poor, capitalists and workers, if they really did have this snap the finger choice and they were only concerned about what's best for themselves? So I'm adding this additional consideration. Their answer to the question can only be what's good for me. So we don't allow for, shall we say, a deeply Christian capitalist who would say, even though it might be better for me to keep the shmoo out of the hands of the poor, I want the poor to have the shmoo because I believe in that moral world. So plenty of rich people have moral motivations, as I said last time, and so therefore they wouldn't act on their self-interest. I'm just asking what their self-interests are here, okay? So it's a narrow question. What's in it for them? And here's the rank ordering. For the rich, their first choice is that only capitalists get schmooze. That is, capitalists would rather have schmooze than not. A lot of capitalists like oatmeal, after all. And having a schmoo makes them a little better off than not having a schmoo. The second preference for capitalists is get rid of them. Let nobody have them. If I'm a capitalist and I'm only concerned about my well-being, I would say, if I can't monopolize them, I don't want anybody to get them. The third preference is that everybody gets them. If you can't destroy them and you can't monopolize them, well, then you might as well give them to everybody. And the worst option is that only the poor get the shmoo. For workers, rank ordering is this. First, everyone gets the shmoo. That's the best possibility. Their second best option, possibilities that only workers get the shmoo. And the third one, now this might surprise some of you, the third best possibility is that only capitalists get shmoos. That is, workers are basically better off if capitalists have shmoos than if capitalists don't have shmoos. And the reason is that if capitalists have shmoos, part of the standard of living, part of the consumption of capitalists will be taken care of by the shmoo. It means that there'll be a little bit more left over in the profits of capitalist firms that could potentially be bargained for higher wages. So there might be a little bit of trickle down. You know, workers in general prefer to work for wealthier capitalists rather than poorer capitalists. Because if you work for a wealthier capitalist, there's more chance, there's more room to maneuver, there's more chance to bargain for better conditions. So workers would actually benefit a little bit if capitalists had shmooze relative to capitalist nothing. And the fourth possible, fourth best choice is simply destroyed. Now, if you look at this rank ordering of preferences, these aren't just different interests that are affected. This is a deeply antagonistic, conflictual set of rank orders, right? It's really sharply opposed to. Because what does this care mean? This preference means I would rather destroy manna from heaven than let poor people get their hands on it. That's a pretty harsh view, yeah. Okay, so the reason why workers want everyone to get the shmoo
is that some workers will want to work for capitalists, even with a shift, because they want to have a vacation in the Bahamas, and they want to save up, so they'll have their basic needs paid for by schmooze, and then they want cash for luxuries. And workers would rather work for a capitalist than have a schmooze, because likely it's going to lose a higher wage. This is a pretty harsh kind of concept of interest. It means that in this context, with respect to the schmooze, the rich have an active interest in the deprivations of the poor. Now, from ordinary sense of morality, it's bad enough to say that the rich are indifferent to the well-being of the poor, right? We think of that as a harsh criticism of highly privileged people, that they are indifferent to the plight of the poor. All religions criticize wealthy people for being indifferent to the plight of the poor. That's why charity is a value in all religions. This doesn't differentiate one religion from another. The idea that the rich should help the poor is a universal moral principle. So being indifferent is bad enough. This is worse than being indifferent to the plight of the poor. This is having a positive interest in what could be called the ill-care. Not the welfare, but the ill-care of the poor. And the reason is that the capitalist all wealth depends upon the deprivation of the residents of Doncaster. They could not recruit a labor force. They couldn't get people to work for them because they had schools. And even if they could get them to work, they were worried that they couldn't get them to work hard because the threat of being fired wouldn't be such a big threat. How do you get workers to work harder than they would want to? One little way of thinking about this is that everybody has a whistle while you work level of effort. Is the reference whistle while you work, is that also lost in the mix? You know where that comes from? Snow White and Seven Dwarfs in the Disney cartoon. The whistle while you work level of effort with the Seven Dwarfs going off mining in this cheerful way. That's the level of effort that people would do simply out of the pleasure of work. The whistle while you work level of effort. Well, when P.U. says in the comic strip, nobody will work hard anymore, what he means is without the threat of being fired and the poverty that results from being fired, you're not going to be able to get workers to work hard. They will only work as hard as they want to, not as hard as he wants. And that means that the employer in this context has an active interest in the deprivations, in the restricted opportunities, in the vulnerability of the workers in this story. That's a pretty harsh structure of interconnected needs. It's what one might think of as the kind of configuration of interest that inherently generates conflict. It inherently generates conflict. People resist being subordinated in such relationships, and that's why employment relationships have an inherent tendency towards conflict rather than towards harmony and collaboration. It's why employment relationships are not really like families. Filled with reciprocity and mutual respect and mutual regard, or at least in the idealized family. Why employment relationships have at their core an antagonistic relationship. And that's captured by this notion of domination and exploitation. Let me now go one step further and ratchet up the level of abstraction at which I'm telling this story. I now want to give you a more theoretical definition of exploitation, which is anchored in the account that we've given in our discussion of schmooze. So just so that you appreciate what you're being exposed to here, This is from my work on, I've written a number of books on this kind of problem, and my scholarly reputation began by working on problems of class and how to understand exploitation, how to develop it in a way that was sociologically relevant. So this is the kind of exposition I would give if I'm invited to a fancy university and asked to give a theoretical lecture to the faculty and grad students. But I figure bright freshmen and sophomores are perfectly capable of grasping this more sophisticated way of specifying the ideas. So exploitation involves the coincidence of three distinct principles. When they all come together, that we can say, yes, this relationship is exploitative. The first principle is what I call the inverse interdependent well-being principle. Inverse interdependent well-being principle. This is a relationship in which the material well-being of the advantaged group of people causally depends upon the material deprivations of the individual. Remember the story of the two farmers, the tomatoes across the land that I told at the beginning of the last lecture. That does not satisfy this first principle. In the two plots of land, at the end of the summer, one farmer had a lot of tomatoes, the other had few. But there was no causal relationship between the advantages of one and the disadvantages of the other. Right? Remember, this is all that happened was that one farmer worked hard all summer, grasshopper farmer, and the other one enjoyed summer activities. Those were independent causes of the bounty and deprivation at the end of the summer, rather than interdependent causes. Nothing about what one farmer did affected what the other one did. The material well-being of the advantaged group of people causally depends upon the material deprivations of the disadvantaged. That means there's inverse interdependent. Inverse means when one goes up, the other goes down.
That's the inverse part.
Interdependent well-being principle. Second principle is the exclusion principle. This is where opportunity hoarding comes into play within inside of exploitation. So opportunity hoarding is present here, but it's only one component of the concept. The causal relationship in A, the first one that we just defined, involves the exclusion of the disadvantaged group from access to certain important productive resources controlled by the advantaged group. So in the simplest case that we've been looking at, the owners of a canning factory that these industrialists wanted to have, they exclude workers from access to those means of production, and therefore are able to hire them. Exclude means that the disadvantaged group only gets access to those means of production on the terms established by the owners. That's the exclusion principle. The third one is the labor effort control principle, which is also called the appropriation principle. Appropriation principle. But think of it as the labor effort control principle. The causal mechanism which translates condition B, exclusion, into condition A, inverse interdependent welfare, the causal mechanism that does that involves control over the labor effort and the profits from that effort of the disadvantaged group by those who control these productive resources. It's the owner of the canning factory that owns all of the products produced by the workers. The factory, from which the owner pays the workers a wage. That means that the owner is able to take all of the fruits of labor, all of the products of laboring effort, to take those and sell them for his or her own profit. That's the labor effort control principle. If all three of these are present, we have the idea of exploitation. if only the first two are present, that is, if we only have inverse interdependent welfare and exclusion, if we just have those two but not the third, we have what could be called non-exploitative oppression. Now, there's a lot of words I'm throwing out at you, a lot of definitions. This is a pretty complex conceptual map. Let me make just a couple of comments. First, I want to give you a comment about what we've just done. This is an example in social theory and sociology of trying to give real precision to an idea. In talking with the TAs, one of the problems that some of you had on the exam was a lack of precision when you're asked to define something. So we, as you know, a lot of the questions have the character of defining something. And some of the definitions were in the ballpark. You know, you were definitely kind of working around the idea, but they weren't precise. And this is a skill to be part of what you learn as undergraduates, hopefully. It's how to go from kind of vague and loose understandings of things to really rigorous and careful, precise understandings. Sometimes this gets parodied as being pedantic. So somebody who's insisting on very precious little nitpicky specificity, that's seen as being a pedantic. And sometimes, of course, there can be what's called false precision or over precision. More precision than needed. So precision is a kind of important and tricky business, and it's something you'll get the feel for. As your academic sophistication goes up, you'll get a feel, whatever your field is. Some of you are chemistry majors, I imagine, other sociologists, whatever. You'll learn the value of precision. And that's what we're doing here. We're taking a very general idea of exploitation, illustrated in the Schmoo story. And now I'm trying to nail it down to give it a precise specification. And part of the precise specification of any concept is to differentiate it from closely allied but different concepts. It's draw demarcation. That's part of what precision is all about. Differentiating a concept from a kissing cousin, closely. And that's what this does. Non-exploitative oppression and exploitation are closely connected but different. Let me just illustrate with a simple example what's meant, an example of non-exploitative oppression compared to exploitation. In North America, when settlers came to North America, they found that the continent had people on it. And that created conflict because the most valuable resource in the 17th and 18th century was land, right? The crucial resource for the society given the level of technology, land. There were people on the land, and displacing people from the land, therefore, was part of the process by which colonization of North America and settlement of North America by Europeans took place. The indigenous people, Native Americans, resisted. And that resistance quickly became violent and genocidal. That is an example of a struggle over opportunity for them. It's an example of non-exploitative oppression. The settlers wanted the land. Their welfare depended upon depriving the indigenous people of the land, pushing them off. There was interdependent welfare. The well-being of one depended upon causal deprivations of the other. That interdependence was based on exclusion, but there was not exploitation. The Native Americans were not brought back onto the land as slaves or as farm workers. They were simply kicked off, excluded. The result of that was genocide. If there's no use for those people were literally useless from the point of view of the European settlers. And it is why in the 19th century, in American folk culture, we have this absolutely horrendous, morally repugnant folk saying, the only good Indian is a dead Indian. And that's a monstrous expression, part of our history. was a popular saying in the 19th century. It's a monstrous idea, no different whatsoever from the Nazi views that view. And it's why the Native American population justifiably calls the settlement of North America as the Native American Holocaust. Justifiably, because it was backed by this doctrine, the only good and human is dead Indian. Now, nobody would ever say the only good worker is a dead worker. The only good slave is a dead slave. You might say the only good slave is a docile slave, or the only good worker is an obedient worker, but that's because workers and slaves have this third principle. The third principle, the exploitation principle, actually gives the slave and the worker a form of power that Native Americans didn't have. And the form of power that workers have and that slaves have is that the wealthy slave owner and the employer needs them. The capitalist depends upon the worker, requiring that hard effort, and that's a source of power for workers because we aren't robots, we control our level of effort, and the most common form of resistance in any system of exploitation is the ability to withhold effort in all sorts of ways. And that was chronic on slave plantations, that slaves withheld effort as best they could, and it's a chronic problem within capitalist production as well. The fact that those are problems reflects the character of these relationships as involving this very strange and difficult relationship diagnosed as exploitation, and it's a key element of this most complex way of understanding class relations.